arise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment. Master Commissioner Robert Mayer presiding.
Please be seated. The first case to be heard this morning is number 2014-1614, International Paper Company versus the Tax Commissioner. The appellant is the Tax Commissioner. Mr. Hubbard, please.
May it please the Court, the Board of Tax Appeals erred in holding the Commissioner's final determination to be void and further erred in directing the Commissioner to grant a commercial activity credit in this case in the originally claimed amount by International Paper of $16,957,000 instead of the amount that the Commissioner determined upon audit and adjustment of $927,000. The Commissioner's final determination was not void for several reasons. And before I get to those reasons, I'd like to point out that the Commissioner's issuance of the final determination in this matter is purely an option, a discretionary option afforded to the Commissioner by the General Assembly's amendment to the original enactment of the commercial activity tax statute. The pertinent provision here is Division D of Section 5751.53, and that was subject to amendment after the original House Bill number 66 that created the commercial activity tax was enacted.
Was that amendment in effect at the time the amortizable amount report was filed?
Yes, I believe it was, Your Honor. Okay. And of course, the due date for filing the amortizable amount report was June 30th of 2006. And I believe the amendment was in 2005. We cite it in our reply brief, and we attach the Legislative Service Commission analysis of that, and I'll get to that later. The point I wanted to make, though, is it's an option, purely an option the General Assembly has allowed the Commissioner to avail himself of. And for good reason, the Commissioner in every one of these commercial activity tax cases under the so-called net operating loss carryforward provision, that's 0.53 of the title of the chapter, the Commissioner has availed himself of that option to issue final determinations because it's one-stop shopping. Instead of the normal course, which he can always do under the statute, it's purely an alternative for him to issue the final determination. He could have reviewed the quarterly commercial activity tax returns, compared the amount that he had determined the credit to be upon audit and adjustment of $927,000, see whether the returns were consistent with that, and then issued an assessment to the extent the taxpayer claimed more than that amount.
Well, if no final determination were sent out, what means would there be to inform the taxpayer of an adjustment or change in the amortizable amount?
Well, excellent question, Your Honor. It's precisely what happened in this case. The Commissioner, by a final audit letter, set forth that amount. He also provided emails. There's no debate in this case, I believe, that, in fact, actual notice of the audit adjustment was received prior to June 30th of 2010.
Now, are those audit letters sent like by certified mail and so forth, or?
Well, the statute doesn't require that it be done in any certain way, but in other words, the statute just says audit and adjust. So, but I believe it was done both by regular mail, not certified mail, and email transmission, and it was acknowledged as received. In fact, the record reflects that it was, quote, accepted by the tax personnel at International Harvester, International Paper, rather.
Would that audit letter, in your view, have been appealable to the BTA by
no.
the taxpayer?
And that's what I'm saying. The normal method would be the Commissioner would, after auditing and adjusting the credit by the June 30th, 2010 due date, then would review the returns. Now, the first period for which that credit could be applied was the first quarter of 2010. So it would be he'd sit down, look at the quarterly filed returns, see whether the credit was claimed. And of course, the credit can only be partially claimed for the first several years, and it extends over a 20-year period. So he would see whether the credit amount as claimed by the taxpayer on its returns was consistent or not with the Commissioner's audit and adjustment of the credit. And if they claim more than what the commissioner's audit and adjustment would indicate, then the commissioner would issue an assessment. And that assessment then would be subject to the right of the taxpayer to file a petition for reassessment. And then, pursuant to the petition for reassessment provision, the commissioner would have a duty to issue a final determination. But it would just be for the assessment periods at issue, and not for all time. Whereas, if the commissioner, without there being an assessment issued, and also the other possibility besides an assessment is the taxpayer could file an application for refund. In other words, let's suppose the commissioner, the taxpayer says, gee, you know, we're looking at the amount of the credit. We think they couldn't claim more than they originally claimed, but they could claim up to the amount they originally claimed and say, we believe the commissioner erred in his audit and adjustment.
So under that approach.
And then they'd have a right to, a final determination on the application for refund, but only for the periods covered by the refund plan.
Under that approach, then, the taxpayer would receive an audit letter on or before June 30th of 2010.
No.
Would that be necessary?
No. The assessment period would be the general statute of limitations applied for the commissioner's issuance of assessments, which is, I believe, a three-year period running from the filing of the returns. In other words, we're not reading 5751.53D as creating any kind of assessment period. It's the period for auditing and adjusting the credit, not for issuing assessments, not for a taxpayer to file a refund claim. But if the commissioner does what he did in this instance by issuing a final determination, that's for all years. Whereas if he does it the other way, he doesn't issue a final determination prior to receiving and prior to an assessment and prior to a petition for reassessment being filed, then it's for all time that the amount of the credit's determined. Whereas if it's done the usual way, which is the commissioner issues his assessment, the taxpayer files a petition for reassessment, the commissioner issues a final determination on the petition, then the amount of the credit is only binding and conclusively determined for the assessment period, not for all time. And we know that from the Consumer Direct case, which is an Ohio corporate franchise tax case that involved the amount of a net operating loss carry forward. And to determine the net operating loss carry forward, you have the base net operating loss amount. And in Consumer Direct, the Ohio Supreme Court held that for taxpayers that were not the subject, there had actually been an adjudication for an assessment period as to the amount of that credit. And then there was a subsequent assessment, and the question was whether the taxpayer and the commission were bound by the earlier determination of the amount of the credit. And the court said no, they weren't, that because the assessment was for a limited, the tax.
That would have been, you're saying it's a franchise tax case, and that would have involved actually taking the net operating loss as a deduction?
Yes, as opposed to here where that net operating loss is converted to a credit by, you know, but effectively the starting point for the credit is the amount, is the net realizable value of the net operating loss carryforwards under the corporate franchise tax. So it was a natural thing for the legislature to address that problem.
Well, under your view, would it be possible for the tax commissioner to change or adjust the amortizable amount?
After June 30th, 2010, no. From the amount that he determined it to be, in this case, $927,000.
Okay.
In other words, that's binding. In other words, the commissioner, that's a separate requirement that emanates from Division D. That's not an assessment limitation. That's a limitation that says by June 30th of 2010, the commissioner shall audit and adjust the credit. Okay. There are several reasons, however, that I'd like to cover as to why the board was wrong. One is the term issue. Excuse me. This is a new problem for me. Basically, what the Board of Tax Appeals said is because the commissioner hadn't mailed the final determination by June 30th of 2010, then the commissioner did not issue the final determination by that date, and there was, in fact, in the board held that there was a June 30th, 2010 due date for the issuance of the final determination. As this, basically, the word issue is applied to final determinations, means the dating and entering into the public journal of the final determination, not its subsequent mailing, which is actually the service of the final determination. So the board was wrong on that. And we know they're wrong for several reasons. One is...
When is under that view, when is the final determination effective? Is it effective when it's journalized, or is
yes.
it effective when
absolutely.
It's...
It becomes a final determination when it's journalized. Okay. And we know that not only from the usage of the term issuance, when we look at Ohio Supreme Court decisions where the court has said the final determination is issued in day one and mailed on day two. They said that in Evilsizer. And also in the DeWeiss case, the court said that the journalization of the final determination, the entry of the final determination, is its issuance. But they also said just last week in the Navistar case, which also involved this very credit, the final determination was entered, dated into the public journal on January 10th of 2010. It's on paragraph 18 of the Navistar decision. And it wasn't actually received by the taxpayer. It wasn't mailed. It was mailed later. So it was received 18 days later. And that's reflective. We look at the statutory transcript in the Navistar case, the last page of that statutory transcript, which is page 184 of the supplement in that case.
Was it mailed after June 30th in
Navistar? Yes, absolutely. We can infer that from the fact that it was journalized on January 10th. That's recited in the decision, and it's evidenced in the record in that case. And then we can look at the actual mailing. The certified mailing shows that it was delivered on January 28th. It's, 17 days later. So there's nothing. January 10th,
July.
January 28th.
Okay.
Sorry, 17 days later. Or January 11th, not January 10th. I'm screwing this up. Thank you. So it's 17 days later it's actually received by certified mail. Okay. So, but even more fundamentally than the fact of the court's usage of the term issuance with respect to final determinations, that's the general rule with all court decisions and administrative final orders, that they're issued when they're publicly journalized and entered into the record of those proceedings. And we cited several other cases. The other side has not cited any cases involving final determinations of administrative agencies or courts. But even more fundamentally than that, the plain meaning of Section 5717.02 dictates that the word issuance of final determination means its entry into the public journal. And that's because if we look at the requirement for the commissioner to serve notice of the final determination on the taxpayers, and that starts the statute of limitations, the 60-day appeal period for filing an appeal to the Board of Tax Appeals from a final determination.
So the appeal period runs from?
Then the service of notice of the final determination. So the commissioner doesn't even need to send by certified mail an actual copy of the final determination. All the commissioner is required to do is give notice of the fact that a final determination has been issued. So the plain meaning of 5717.02 dictates that the mean of issuance of final determinations is their journalization. Another reason 5717.02, the plain meaning requires that the term issuance means journalization and entry of the final determination, is that there are parties who may appeal from a final determination of the commissioner, including the Director of Office of Budget and Management, they don't receive a mailing of the final determination, but they have a right of appeal. And so what's their time period for appealing? It begins to run from the issuance of the final determination, which is the public journalization. And also, if we look at the rationale behind that's in sum why issuance is not mailing. I mean, sorry, that mailing is not issuance, it's journalization, which is mailing is service, and it's actually mailing of the notice. Of the final determination, not the final determination itself that's required under 5717.02. But another problem that the board had, and it's fundamental, it's independent, is that there's no due date in 57 for the issuance of the final determinations. It's a laudable thing for the commissioner to exercise his option of issuing a final determination without there having been any assessment or application for refund. And the purpose of this legislation to allow that option is so that the amount of the credit can be determined for all time, for all tax years, binding on both the commissioner and the taxpayer. And that would be throwing the baby out with the bathwater if the court were to read in a due date for that. If we look at the original legislation that didn't have the option for the commissioner to issue a final determination without having an assessment or application for refund first, we will see that it didn't even provide there was no option to issue the final determination. It had to be through the regular, the normal course of, you know, well, filing a petition. And
the current version of the statute has the word necessary in it, necessary to correct any errors found on audit. How does that relate to your argument? When is it necessary?
It's necessary to audit and adjust by June 30th, 2010. So it's necessary in order to correct them, in order to make the credit the right credit amount in accordance with the statute. That's what they're referring by necessary. Okay. And you're saying if necessary.
Well, I'm just looking at the statute. It says it has the audit and adjust, or if appropriate, issue any assessment or final determination as applicable necessary to correct. So it appears that the necessary relates to issuing the assessment.
Yeah, what I would say that is they're saying they want to make sure that the final determination is just for the credit. It's necessary. In other words, it's not a final determination on all CAT issues for a particular assessment period. It's just for the credit. So it's necessary for this credit. A commercial activity taxpayer's liability, of course, is determined by the application of the entire chapter, not just this CAT credit provision. I think that necessary is relating to a reference to necessary. In other words, it's relating to this credit and only this credit. In other words, the commissioner couldn't jump step and then issue a final determination for the entire amount of the liability for a particular period. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Hubbard. Your light's on, unfortunately. Mr. Farron, can I ask you to comment on what your interpretation of the word necessary is?
Certainly, Your Honor. The reason the term is in there is because if the commissioner's audit determines that the amortizable amount report claimed, or the amortizable amount claimed by the taxpayer on its report, should be reduced, he has to issue a final determination that reduces it to that amount that he decided was entitled to under the CAT credit provision.
So your reading of it is that if the commissioner's audit and adjustment leads to a reduction of the amortizable amount, that it is then necessary for him to issue an assessment or final determination?
Absolutely, Your Honor, because that's the only way a taxpayer would have an ability to contest the reduction.
Well, there's at least some ambiguity to that, because it says audit the accuracy of the amortizable amount available to each taxpayer that will claim the credit and adjust the amortizable amount. So there's an adjustment that's possible. And then it says or,
right.
And then we get all this language about the final determination. Well, how do you read that?
Well, certainly if the adjustment is favorable, he doesn't have to issue a final determination. But if the commissioner says, I'm going to adjust it, you're entitled to less than you claimed, he necessarily has to issue a final determination so that the taxpayer has a right to challenge that by appealing it to the Board of Tax Appeals. It's necessary because the taxpayer has to have a right to challenge it. It isn't just a fiat by the tax commissioner that says, this is all you're getting and you can't complain about it.
Is there any dispute about what Mr. Hubbard said about the issuance of the audit letter and the actual notice?
Well, there was no issuance of an audit letter.
Using a loaded term.
There were communications back and forth. In fact, they did get an initial, whether it was a letter or an email from the Department of Taxation telling it that it was going to get zero credit. Later on, the department sent an email or a letter to the taxpayer saying, you're now entitled to $927,000. There were communications. There was no certified letter, no official notice that went out.
And there was more than one, and it set it at different amounts.
Yes.
So International Paper could have thought at any time after that there might yet be another audit letter.
Well, they assumed, and they were told by the Department of Taxation people through various emails, that they would receive a final determination. And in fact, one of the emails that clearly shows the understanding of the tax commissioner with respect to the requirement to issue a final determination by the statute of limitations provided in 53D is the international paper said, can you extend the time? And there is an option for a mutual extension. The tax commissioner's personnel sent an email saying the administration had decided to deny the extension and will proceed to issue the final determination by the statute date of June 30th, 2010. They realized that they had to issue the final determination issue to mail it out to the taxpayer.
Well, it was journalized before that date.
It was made. It was journalized. It was not issued, which this court specifically defined the term issue in the Carstab case. It defined the term made, and it determined defined the term issued. It said the term made is the journalization, and it dealt with assessments. It said the journalization of the assessment. The term issued is placing it or depositing it in the mail, and they actually also distinguish the third event is the service. Service is different than issue. Service, as that term is used, means received by an appropriate person at the taxpayer's address. It's not just placing in the mail. So there were three events that Carstab specifically defined, and the one major term that's applicable here is issued. And the attempt to suggest that other courts' decisions have defined the term issued or issuance differently is just wrong. There's not a single case, not one of the cases cited by the tax commissioner, even remotely involved the meaning of the term issued. Half of them didn't even contain the term in the decision. It was, two of the cases in the introductory material of the decision, which under this court's rules for the reporting opinions isn't considered part of the decisional law in the case, simply made the statement the assessment or the final determination was issued. But those cases didn't decide the term. The statutes at issue in those cases were not even statutes that use the term issued. They use a term, it was a time from the date of service or the time from the date of entry. They didn't use the term issue. Clearly, Carstab is the only case that was presented with and decided the meaning of the term issued with respect to final adjudications issued by the tax commissioner. And the General Assembly enacted 57, 51, 53D, in fact, the entire CAT, subsequent to the time that this court defined the term issued. And they used the term issued. And if you look at 53D, they didn't distinguish between assessments and final determinations. The statute says, issue any assessment or final determination. They use the same word. If they intended it to have a different meaning, they would have, with respect to final determination, said, enter, journalize, file, make. They wouldn't have used the term issue to mean something different than this court had decided. It already decided in the Carstab case. And attempting to distinguish that, assessments and final determinations are both made under the same section, 570305H. They're both required to be served on taxpayers under 570337 by certified mail or personal delivery. They're both journalized. At the time of Carstab, the statute 570305L required assessments to be placed on the public journal. The current version of that statute requires final determinations to be placed on the public journal. In fact, in Carstab, the court said that it noted that, yes, assessments are required to be placed on the public journal, but that is the making of the assessment. It then decided that the issuing of the assessment was placing it in the mail for delivery to the taxpayer. And that's the definition of issue that the Board of Tax Appeals applied in this case. And the board also noted that's also consistent with the dictionary definition of the term issue, that is, to send to. And again, the cases cited by the commissioner simply didn't remotely decide that issue. The Castellano case, which the commissioner relies on and points out has been cited several times. The question was whether the period for filing a petition for reassessment runs from the date of service of the date the service is effectuated or the date it's actually received by the taxpayer. That statute, 5739.13 at the time, provided that the petition had to be filed within 30 days after service. The term filing wasn't even contained in that statute. The court clearly didn't define the term issue in that case. It was not a contested issue. DeWeese and Evilsizer, similarly, did not even remotely consider or determine the definition of the term issue. Other cases, Swofford and LaPlante, dealt with administrative appeals under 2505.07. Again, the time for appeals under those runs from the entry of the administrative decision. In fact, the term issue wasn't even contained in those cases. The Westside Hospital case, which is a non-Ohio case cited by the tax commissioner, first of all, we already have the Carstab case from this court that determined the meaning of that term. The Westside Hospital case, which involved a fairly complex and multi-step administrative process, did hold that the term issuance meant filing. However, the court itself notes that other appellate courts in California, this is California Appellate Court, had reached a contrary conclusion. The Sunnyside Nurseries case, cited in Westside Hospital, specifically said that issuance means both filing and service or mailing to the taxpayer or to the petitioner in that case. It wasn't a tax case. Now, on the second issue, first of all, the commissioner refers to the board's decision as voiding its final determination. What the board held was that the tax commissioner was barred by the statute of limitations in 57-51-53D from reducing the amortizable amount claimed by the taxpayer because it did not issue its final determination within the statute of limitations period. It's a statute of limitations. Now, the commissioner argues that the limitation period applies only to his audit and adjustment of the amortizable amount, but not to his assessment, issuance of assessments or final determinations. Well, that fails under a plain reading of that statute. You cannot parse out the last clause in that statute regarding issue any assessment or final determination. The authority granted to the tax commissioner to reduce or consider the amortizable amount is contained in the section. It says, unless extended by mutual consent, the tax commissioner may until June 30th, 2010. And then it lists all the things the commissioner is authorized to do: audit, adjust, issue assessments, and issue final determinations. The last clause can't stand by itself. Just the basic sentence structure, you can't pull out, you know, the tax commissioner may, and then just put it down in front of issue any assessment or final determination. It is the entire sentence is conditioned upon that first clause, unless extended by mutual consent. Well, if the commissioner isn't required to issue an assessment or final determination within the statute, what's to be extended by mutual consent? I'll also, if we look at the effect or results or consequences of the construction, here a taxpayer files his amortizable amount report. All of the information necessary to do the calculation is there, because it all has to be as of the end of 2004. So the commissioner says, well, I can audit and adjust it, and then just wait for as much as 20 years, which is the time over which the credit can be taken, and then issue an assessment or a final determination. Well, why would the General Assembly intend that? It intended this special procedure to put finality, to make sure that the taxpayer could book the asset. The taxpayer had to book this asset. The whole purpose of the credit was to offset the financial impact of the loss of the NOLs for franchise tax purposes. Well, that had to be booked early on. So the taxpayer had to have the ability to book this asset to offset the impact. The taxpayer also had to start taking the credit in 2010, which not coincidentally is consistent with the statute of limitations on the final determination of the amortizable amount. Finally, think of the impact. The whole purpose of a statute of limitations is to protect against a person having to defend against stale claims. 10 years from now, if the commissioner issues a final determination, the taxpayer may not have any records. The taxpayer may not have the people available who are knowledgeable. The tax commissioner's auditor might not be around. And if it's done 15, 20 years later, it's highly unlikely. The whole purpose of a statute is to protect against that. Those are the reasons that the General Assembly put in this special statutory procedure where everything was determined by June 30, 2010, or an extended due date, mutually agreed to. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Farron. Mr. Hubbard, you've reserved 50 seconds for rebuttal.
Okay, basically, Your Honor, what my respected colleague said is completely wrong in terms of how it actually works. Basically, in this case, the final determination becomes final and conclusive under our view for $927,000. The taxpayers file quarterly tax CAT returns. If they're claiming more than that amount as the credit, we would go in and issue an assessment, and then they would file a petition. So it's not, and if the commissioner has all, remember, the commissioner has to audit and adjust the credit by the June 30th, 2010 due date. It's purely optional whether we issue a final determination. The reply brief appendix at page 17 has the original.
Didn't the audit letters and so forth indicate that the commissioner here was going to file?
No, those letters stood separate apart. The letter said this is a final audit. This is what the amount is, and in fact, that was communicated. So the idea that it's a stale claim and everything is ridiculous. We have to have provided, unless it was extended mutually, audit and adjust by June 30th, 2010. We did so. That's what was required. The Legislative Service Commission analysis of the original bill and the amended bill expressly say that. My colleague totally disregarded that, and we would ask the court to look at that as well, because the court, that's buttressing our position. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hubbard. This case will be submitted, and the court will advise the parties of its decision.